Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a really close look at some source material dealing with claims of an authoritarian slide here in the U.S.
That's right. And this set of sources, it's quite specific. It's not just listing worries. It's really trying to analyze an alleged playbook.
A playbook, meaning?
Meaning the specific methods, historical comparisons, the language strategies that these sources claim are being used by, well, authoritarian movements.
Okay. And the core source material we're growing from.
It features analysis from Professor Jason Stanley quite heavily. He's a philosopher who works a lot on propaganda, fascism, gives him a particular lens on political language.
Right.
And his argument, or the argument presented in the sources, is essentially that a kind of coup is happening, but it's less about overt force and more about narrative control. Storytelling.
Okay, storytelling. Let's unpack that right away. The source material says something like, storytelling is such a powerful tool utilized by authoritarians, it is often more effective than brute force.
Exactly. I mean, if you think about it, if you can successfully redefine reality for a new people, then your opponents aren't just mistaken, they become sort of dangerous enemies.
It reframes the whole conflict.
Right. And historically, authoritarian movements, they often do prioritize controlling media, education, the public conversation. Because if you control that, maybe you don't need as much overt violence later on. You substitute structural control for, you know, boots on the ground, initially at least.
And the sources link this idea of narrative control directly to targeting dissenters, systematically.
Yes, and this is where they start drawing historical comparisons. But interestingly, they argue the current situation might be potentially worse than, say, the McCarthy era.
Worse how? That's a big claim.
Well, the sources cite the alleged scale and speed. They mention numbers like 40 academics dismissed supposedly over pretty innocuous social media stuff, and then lots of other people fired across different jobs.
Wow, 40. That does sound like, well, more than just random incidents. It suggests efficiency.
Yeah, a systemic feel. And the sources, they really zeroed in on one case, the alleged firing of Karen Attia from the Washington Post.
She was their only remaining Black opinion columnist.
And that's what the source states, yes. And it claims the firing was over utterly innocuous posts about certain political figures.
So the claimed motive isn't necessarily that these people are radicals.
No, not necessarily. According to the sources, the focus is on anyone whose views or truth-telling just does not fit their narrative. So the idea is, any excuse will do, right? An old tweet, a comment taken out of context. It's used to sideline people seen as politically inconvenient, making sure the voices left are ones that fit the, quote, new mandate. It creates a chill.
A chilling effect, yeah. That makes sense if you're trying to control the story.
Exactly.
Okay, so this alleged targeting, this narrative control, it brings us to the historical blueprints you mentioned. The sources claim current strategies aren't new. They echo specific European events.
That's right. They argue understanding these historical moments is pretty key to seeing the alleged strategy today. Two main examples come up. First, the Reichstag fire, Germany, 1933.
Right. The German parliament building burned down. An alleged communist was blamed.
Yes. And the key point the sources make is how Hitler used that event. It became the pretext, the justification.
For what exactly?
For emergency action. He flooded the streets with what the source calls official thugs. State actors used for intense voter intimidation. This atmosphere of crisis and fear then provided the cover to pass the Enabling Act.
And the Enabling Act was?
Basically, the law that let Hitler take dictatorial powers legally by passing the parliament. It's a cornerstone moment.
So the fire wasn't just a tragedy, it was the lever for a power grab. What's the parallel the sources see today?
They draw an analogy to the potential mobilization of groups like ICE. The idea isn't that it's identical, but that a rapid militarized use of state force, even if initially aimed at something like immigration, could function similarly, creating fear, intimidating opposition.
Okay. And the second historical blueprint?
Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. Again, triggered by a single event, a German diplomat assassinated in Paris by a Polish Jew.
And the reaction?
Immediate, widespread, coordinated violence against Jewish people, shops, synagogues.
Yep.
It showed how a single incident could be used to justify massive targeted reprisals.
So the pattern seems to be find or create a trigger event, then use it to justify a crackdown.
That's the analysis presented. And linking this to today's legal landscape, the sources talk about alleged efforts to set up the legal groundwork for invoking the Insurrection Act.
The Insurrection Act, That allows the president to deploy the military domestically, right? Bypassing normal restrictions.
Yes, exactly. It overrides the Posse Comitatus Act. It's an extreme measure historically.
And the sources mentioned Trump considered this before.
They do. They say he toyed with this after the George Floyd protests, but was apparently advised it won't hold up legally at that time. The suggestion in the source material is that work continues, behind the scenes, to build a stronger legal case for using it in the future.
So it's not just about having the law, it's about having the justification ready. The narrative trigger.
Yes. And this is where the sources mention that extremely serious, specific hypothetical event that they claim is being weaponized.
Mm.
The alleged attempt to seize authority following the tragic Charlie Kirk assassination.
Okay, we need to be crystal clear here for our listeners. This event, the assassination, is presented in the source material as a specific alleged crisis or hypothetical scenario that they claim is being used as the justification for potential crackdowns. It's their example of a modern Reichstag fire moment.
That's the absolutely crucial context. It's presented as the incident used to test the waters, basically.
Understood. So if history provides the alleged playbook, then language provides the justification, the grease for the wheels.
Exactly. Language is critical. The sources really zero in on the strategic value of labeling political opponents, journalists, nonprofits, even mainstream Democrats, as terrorists or domestic extremist organizations.
Stephen Miller's name comes up here?
Yes. His rhetoric is cited as a prime example. The goal, according to the sources, is immediate delegitimization. If someone's a terrorist, the state suddenly has much broader powers to act against them.
And they argue the term radical left is being stretched.
Dramatically so. The claim is the aim is to lump anyone who, say, accurately calls them a fascist, using the source's language, under that same extremist umbrella. It's about silencing criticism by attacking the critic.
Okay.
And the sources point out how useful a lack of clear definition can be. They look at the attempts to label Antifa, which they stress isn't really a formal organization, as a terrorist group.
Right. It's more of a movement or an ideology.
Exactly. So if you can declare a sort of non-organization, a terrorist entity, what are you actually declaring war on?
Political opposition in general, potentially.
That's the implication drawn by the sources. This incredibly broad net means, theoretically, almost any opposition could eventually be framed as terrorism, justifying action.
And the sources suggest this narrative push happens whether the public is fully convinced or not.
Yeah, the argument is the narrative isn't primarily for persuasion, it's for justification within the government, within the executive branch.
Mm.
It lets them act as if they're fighting terrorists, regardless of public opinion.
Okay, then the source material pivots a bit, talking about distraction. It argues terms like radical left are basically empty labels here, because America isn't fundamentally a radically left country,
right?
And that these terms are used to attack very mainstream nonviolent ideas.
This is a really key part of their analysis. They argue that things being painted as radical are often policies that are, well, pretty normal elsewhere, like free bus services, affordable childcare, universal healthcare access.
Things focused on basic living standards.
Exactly. Or movements just seeking affordable lives, basic dignity. They mentioned Zohran Mamdani's campaign as an example. The radical label, they argue, is a deliberate misrepresentation.
So the source calls this the classic structure of an autocrat throwing cultural meat on the fire. Get people arguing about labels like hippies or radicals.
So they don't look closely at the economic policies being pushed. That's the claim.
And what is the alleged underlying economic motive, according to these sources?
Well, the argument presented is that the culture war serves as a smokescreen, a cover to justify policies like taking away people's health care and fundamentally redistributing wealth upwards towards billionaires and the wealthy elite.
Mm.
The autocrat, in this analysis, uses state power, even violence, ultimately to protect the economic interests of their own family and their wealthy backers.
That's a very strong claim connecting culture wars directly to elite economic gain. Is that presented as interpretation, or do they back it with hard data in the source?
Largely presented as an interpretive connection. The sources connect the dots, basically. They argue if you strip away the cultural rhetoric, the actual policies being advanced heavily favor wealth concentration, deregulation, and cutting social safety nets. The culture war is the performance that masks that alleged oligarchic agenda.
Okay. So putting it all together, what's the picture of the power structure that emerges from these sources? It sounds pretty bleak.
It does. They describe an autocratic authoritarian perspective that they claim essentially controls the Supreme Court, commands one entire political party, and influences an out-of-control executive branch. It suggests a deep structural consolidation of power.
But despite that grim picture, they do offer a counterpoint, something about resistance.
Yes, there's an important note of optimism, or perhaps realism. They specifically highlight that the alleged attempt to consolidate power after that hypothetical Charlie Kirk assassination crisis, it didn't work.
And why didn't it work, according to them?
Because of enormous pushback. That's the key phrase.
So the conclusion isn't just despair?
No, not at all. The conclusion drawn is that full societal resistance, nonviolent resistance, is crucial and effective. Even if these moves are attempted, the sources insist they can be stopped. That pushback example is offered as proof that resistance actually matters. It helps.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of this deep dive. We've gone from the power of narrative over force through historical alleged blueprints like the Reichstag fire, analyzing the language used to label opponents as terrorists,
yes,
all culminating in the claim that this serves to distract from and justify a radical redistribution of wealth towards a select elite.
Right. So a final thought perhaps for you, our listener, to consider, drawn from the material.
Well, the sources make a strong point that things like wanting affordable lives, accessible health care, child care, what might be termed democratic socialism, is presented as fundamentally nonviolent and not inherently radical. So the question the material leaves us with is, if the political opposition finds it necessary to paint these basic human dignity demands as radical left, as something justifying state crackdowns, what does that reveal about the real fight they're trying to wage, maybe beyond the surface-level culture wars? Something to think about. Thank you for joining us for this very detailed deep dive. We definitely encourage you to pay attention to how political labels get used, how they frame debates, and the information you consume. We'll be back soon with another analysis.